Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. And we're in the X section of the lib section of the L section of Slackware packages. So the first one on my list is libxkbcommon, which, yes, okay, that's correct. I thought that was actually kind of wrong for a minute, but now I'm remembering. Okay, so libxkbcommon is, it stands for something like X keyboard extension. That's what that is. XKB, X keyboard extension. So its name, I guess, is a little deceptive because it's not actually just for X. It's not just Zorg. It is also for Wayland and other systems as well. But this is the thing. This is the subsystem on your computer that makes your computer aware of how your keyboard is laid out. And that's one of those things that when you realize that that's software, you just think, I don't know, for me, it made me view keyboards differently. You know, for such a long time, the keyboard was just, it was just the keyboard. It was just this device that made letters appear on a computer. And I never, for such a long time, I didn't really think of how a computer understood it. I just always kind of assumed that it was sending very specific signals to the computer. But it's actually, I mean, it is. It's sending key codes to the computer. But those are just binary signals. What do those translate into? Well, for there to be a trans, you know, something, if you're getting signals, then you need a legend, you need a map, you need a key code or a codec, you know, you need something, you need a way to decode the signal. And it's the signal is, you know, like the A key on a keyboard. Is that the A key or is that just a key? I guess that was a bad example. On the leftmost, on your left finger of your left hand. I don't know. Is the return key a return key or is it just a key over way over on the right of your keyboard? Well, it turns out that they're just keys. They're just keys at a certain position on your keyboard. And what you actually want that to produce when you press it is entirely dependent upon the computer. The way that libxkbcommon understands what you want is through a key map. And that's what xkbcommon provides, are key maps for common keyboards. They are stored in user share x11/locale, I think. Something like that. Yeah. Yep, that's it. And you'll see a bunch of layouts there in user share x11 locale. You'll find a bunch of different keyboard layouts. And are how easy are they to decipher? Are they at all easy to decipher? Let's look at one real quick. Well, you know what? There's the compose file. It has always proven pretty useful to me. That's how you make different characters appear on your keyboard through by pressing a set combination of keys in a specific order. Now, in order for that to work, you need to hit a compose key. You probably don't have a key labeled compose on it on your keyboard, so you have to designate a key in KDE or your Plasma desktop, I mean, or in GNOME or whatever desktop you're using. You have to designate one key to be the special compose key, and then once you press that compose key and then a certain combination of letters, then you produce a different character, a unique character. So for instance, if I hit my right alt key and then press OC, I get the copyright symbol. I don't get the letters OC. I enter compose. So now I'm in compose mode, and then I hit O and nothing visually happens, and then C, and then that completes that sequence and types and results in the copyright symbol on my screen, in my terminal in this case, is what I'm typing into. So that's how compose sequences work, and those are defined thanks to XKB Common, because they came up with that series of letter combinations to produce a specific glyph on your screen. But it can be even simpler than that. It can just be the difference between a US standard QWERTY keyboard and a US Dvorak keyboard. Or it could be the difference between a US keyboard and a UK keyboard, or a French keyboard, or a German keyboard, and so on. libxkbcommon is the library that parses all of that information, and it does provide an API so that programmers can use this in their applications. Is there a better API? Why, yes, there is. And that's the next one in the list, libxclavier. If you go to freedesktop.org/wiki/software/libxclavier, KLAVIER, then you can read all about it. And so this is basically just it's another layer of interactions for developers to use to talk to keyboards, or to parse the input of a keyboard. There is a short document regarding, quote, why multiple layouts rock, and it's available in LibreOffice format or in PDF, but the LibreOffice format is a fun one. It's SXW is the extension, and I'm thinking that's got to be like Star Office or something, because what is SXW? I'd never seen that before. Anyway, it opens up in LibreOffice, and yeah, it's talking a lot about the LibxClavier API and why it provides a couple of extra features that libkbcommon does not. I'm not going to go into it because it's they say it's a short document, but it's a pretty good read. It's a lengthy read is what I'm saying, but it's also a good read. Like, you should check that out if you're at all interested in this sort of thing, because it is interesting. Okay, next up is libxml2. This is a C library to parse XML. This was one of the first development libraries I personally ever used. It's kind of funny, when I first used libxml2, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about, I barely knew anything about XML. I just knew that I had XML that I needed to parse. This was at a job. I had XML that I needed to parse, and so I was looking for a way to parse it. And just the internet just ended up leading me to libxml2. Now, at the time, I did not understand really. I should have, because I was compiling stuff and using, you know, I was linking to libraries and stuff in a very manual way, but I didn't quite understand what a library was at the time. And so it was really confusing to me. And I wonder if their website is basically the same to this day. Because I went to the website. No, it's completely different. I went to the website, and it didn't, you know, it I guess it, to be fair, I mean, it said, no, it is the same. Yeah, okay. So go to xmlsoft.org. This is how I found this library eventually. You know, I ended up here, and it wasn't really clear to me how this worked. And in my head, I think I thought this was like a command. I think I thought that's how you programmed, was that you just gathered a bunch of commands together and made them work in synchronization. And I didn't quite understand how to import a library yet. So I was kind of, yeah, I was in between a lot of different sort of almost understanding something, but not quite. And so this was my first library experience. And I finally figured out that, yeah, you had to write a C code, a C, you had to write C code, and you were going to be using functions and things from this libxml thing. But how to find that out, what function did what function is even available? I mean, it's just such a, I mean, it's days and days and days of learning new things to just to conceptualize some of this stuff. And I never did. The whole project sort of just fell apart eventually because I just couldn't make any headway. And looking back, of course, I'm just thinking, oh man, there were so many ways to parse XML that didn't involve libxml. But if you are writing C code and you need to parse XML, libxml 2 technically is the exact library here, libxml2 from xmlsoft.org. That's the way to do it. That's one of the ways to do it. You can import that library into your C code, and you've got a bunch of functions that can look at the XML. Now, the with C code especially, like, yes, you've got a library that understands stuff, but I mean, do you understand what to do with the data that you're being given from C? You know, there's a lot of juggling around of data that needs to be done, and that's if you're not super familiar with C and how it reads information and what you can do with it, then you know you're going to be learning something quite different. In other words, this is not like an XML parser for Lua or Python. This is just raw C. And so it what sounds like, oh my gosh, there's a library for that, that'll be easy, it's like, yeah, but you're still writing in C. Is that easy? Maybe not. So I don't know, personally, yeah, like XML, if I was going to parse it, me, I'd probably just parse it with Java or Python or Lua, something. Okay, libxslt. This is the library providing XSL transform for XML. XSL is the style sheet technology. I think I've talked about this before when probably I was talking about XSLT proc or something. Yeah, XSL is essentially the style sheet of XML, and it's kind of a beast. It's no CSS, let's say that. It is a set of rules and matching rules that you write, and you're writing it in XML, and then you're applying it to XML, and it's interesting. It really is. I have written entire web pages in XSL, and it was an interesting experience. Is it practical? Is it something that you should do? No, not really. It is an interesting exercise in parsing data, though. So libxslt is the library that provides style sheet ability to your C application. This is the kind of stuff being used by DocBook and that sort of thing. That's how data in XML is processed. The nice thing about XML and XSL and all that other stuff is that it's just so darned explicit. Like, there, it's just so if something is enclosed in two tags, then that is unquestionably the data that you're looking for. You know, it's very easy to identify. So there's, I love it in that sense, but I fully admit it, that it's not always the easiest thing to parse. Neither is YAML, which in fact is the next library on the list, libyaml. YAML is yet another markup language, or ain't another markup language, and it is a method of listing data, or of providing value and key pairs. That's what YAML does. That's literally the two things that it does. It can create a list. It can create a, you know, what you might call a dictionary in Python terminology, which is not a bad thing to relate it to, because Python and YAML share some quirks, such as really, really being very picky about indentation, unfortunately. So I do like YAML. I mean, like, in theory, I'm quite familiar with YAML now. So I think this whole Stockholm syndrome, really. I mean, it's like, I like it because I am familiar with it. I don't know that I would like it otherwise. And once again, it's not always the easiest thing to parse, because there's so many just kind of like conditions that you have to look for in order to parse it. But libyaml can help you do that in your C code. And that's nice, because someone else has already written the conditions. And those conditions are things like, well, how much is this thing indented compared to that other thing? And if this is indented more than that, is it a valid, does it contain a valid data type? Is it a list, or is it a dictionary? Or as they say in YAML, is it a mapping or a sequence? Those are the two data types in in YAML. There you can map things, which again, it's basically a value and a key value pair, or is it a sequence? And a sequence is just, it's a list. It is a, it, it's a series of values and that's it. Now you can mix the two together. For instance, you can have a sequence in a mapping. So you could have a value like, I guess it would be a key, would be maybe Linux distributions colon, and then a sequence of distribution names indented underneath that. So you'd indent it and you'd have Fedora and Ubuntu and Slackware and so on. Now, if you're trying to parse that yourself, like, and I don't know, in a bash script or something, then, you know, I don't know how you would do it. You'd have to count the indentations. And then if you judge that this thing is indented more than the line above it, then yes, it is a child of that thing. And then you'd have to check, well, what was the data type that I judged the previous line to be? Was it a sequence or was it a mapping? And given that information, can this current line validly be a mapping? Well, with libyaml, all of that logic is already being figured out in the library for you. And all you have to do is include it in your code and then use whatever function it provides to parse that YAML data into what format you actually want it in. And that's a lot of times what all of this stuff boils down to, is that the data is contained in one format and you need to get it into something else, whether it's just, I just need the value assigned to that key because this is a configuration file. Well, then you have to use the function to find that key and then to just extract the value and put the value into a variable and then read that variable into your application or whatever. Next up is libzip, and it's a C library for creating zip files or reading, creating, and modifying zip archives. That's important if you are writing an application and, for instance, you want to be able to zip up the data for your user, whether it's because that's how you're managing file, you know, your file format. Like, LibreOffice files are actually zip files. You may not have known that, but they are. Like, if you extract a LibreOffice write document, like an ODT, with zip, you'll see all the XML and stuff that's contained within that document. You could do that in your own application, in your C code. Every time your user saves their data, you could zip it up and put a different extension on it and say, that's my file type. And that's not an unreasonable way to do things. That keeps all the data that they need for their file together and kind of out of their own way. I mean, it can be a stupid way to obfuscate stuff too, but generally I think a lot of times in open source, it's used to keep logically related files together in a convenient little archive package. So libzip helps you do that. The thing it doesn't help you do is get coffee. So we'll have to do that ourselves. Let's go do it. We'll come back, finish up the show. I have to admit, it kind of feels like we would never reach this point, but we're here. We are out of the lib section within the lib section, as I've said frequently at the end of shows, of course, that just because we're past lib whatever doesn't mean we're out of the L section. We're just out of the lib naming scheme. So there's still quite a lot to go within the library software set, but at least we're past the lib. We're up to L something else now, and specifically that's lmdb. But first, I should mention the summertime coffee blend from Flight Coffee. I keep saying don't attribute too much to Flight Coffee. Just because I rave about Flight Coffee every other episode doesn't mean that there's anything that special about Flight Coffee. But the more I talk about it on this show, the more I kind of start to think that maybe there is, because frankly, the coffee is really good from Flight Coffee. I don't recommend trying to order it from New Zealand. The shipping would be outrageous, but if you're here, try Flight Coffee. As they do, they came out with a special sort of like, you know, limited time only coffee blend for the summer here in New Zealand. Obviously, it's winter in the Northern Hemisphere, but here it's summer, so summertime coffee. So I ordered it. I'm always up for a seasonal coffee. I'm a sucker for that sort of thing. I don't know why. I guess just because it's something different. But the summertime, last summer, it was something else. It was not summertime coffee. It was, I actually have the card for it back there on the bookshelf, but don't have it in front of me, so I'll skip over it. But it was, oh, what was it? Something funny. It was like, I don't know, the Big Chill or the Cozy. No, that was Cozy. Was the Big Cozy was winter, obviously. Yeah, I don't remember. But the summertime blend this year is really quite good. There's it is described as having sort of the flavor of apricot, an after flavor of apricot. And to be honest, there is a little bit of a flavor of apricot. Again, it's not literal flavoring. They don't like put apricot syrup into the thing or something. It's a flavor that evokes to you, or might evoke to you, kind of an earthy, fruity flavor, and that is there. And it's really, really good. I've tried it in my mocha pot, I've tried it in the plunger, and I've tried it in the stovetop percolator. And yeah, it's a good, a bright coffee is the term I keep using for these coffees that I'm really enjoying. I think I'm kind of a weirdly, I'm a sucker for mild. Well, I guess I'm really just a sucker for coffee, because I was gonna say mild coffee, but that's different than bright coffee to me, and that's different than deep or rich coffee. So I quite like all of them, but I guess I like the variety, so the diversity. So really good coffee, summertime from Flight. That's what I'm having right now. And we're going to talk about LMDB, not to be confused with IMDB, the Internet Movie Database. This is a database. It is a LibM database, which I think, from what I'm ascertaining, the M is for memory, I think. I couldn't exactly find that stated explicitly, but the big feature of MDB, which was developed for OpenLDAP, apparently. But MDB, the big feature here is that it maps the database to memory. So you're kind of using a database just kind of like out of RAM. So it's super, super fast. And I couldn't quite gather from the source code, which I did look at. I don't have a complete picture, like a workflow of how the data gets from here to there and then back to here, because even though you're using this ultra fast, like we're talking 250,000 index searches per second on a million record table, that's not a test that I ran, it's a test that some people on the internet ran, but that's the kind of numbers we're talking about. So really, really fast, real-time memory database functionality, but it doesn't just live in memory, or else if there was a power outage, you would lose your data. So it does get written to disk eventually. So I'm assuming there's some kind of almost, you might even think of it as like a journaling process or something. Or maybe it's completely different. Like I say, I couldn't quite unravel it with the quick read through that I did of the source code. It is open source. The source code is right there. You can look at it yourself and see if you can figure it out. Studying it long enough, you probably will be able to. It's possible. If you study it long enough, it's possible to understand what's happening. I don't know, and this is why I just did a quick read through, whether, you know, it's all that important to understand what's happening. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, as they say. You use MDB, and it's pretty darn fast. Faster than just trying to read databases off of your standard spinny disk. Is it faster than something off of NVMe? I don't know. Anecdotally, I can say that RAM disk is very, very fast. I think I've mentioned before that I've really taken to using a RAM disk pretty much as my downloads folder. And sometimes I very unwisely, this is not recommended, I very unwisely kind of use it as a working directory. I shouldn't do that. I try to not do it, but to be honest, I do it. And it just, it opens files so quickly. It saves things quickly. It's a noticeable difference, which is fascinating to me because NVMe was a notable difference from solid, or, you know, the old solid state drives. I don't know what they are, but you know, the normal ones, the SATA ones, I guess. And that was, of course, a notable difference from a spinning disk. So you just keep going further and further to, I guess we're down to that point where every sort of couple of microseconds makes a difference to your, to whether something is noticeable or not. And I'm at the point where, yeah, a couple of microseconds, I guess I'm starting to be able to detect that. I mean, I don't know if it's literally a couple of microseconds, but you know what I mean? Like the difference between opening a big old PDF, which, you know, slow to open every time, right? But the difference between opening that PDF from a spinny disk or an SDD or NVMe or RAM disk, is just, there's no question about it. It's faster on RAM. So big difference for accessing data, huge difference. And that's really significant for a big old database when you're doing anything that's supposed to be interactive, something that people might notice, a delay. And where that delay might cause people to stop using the thing, that's a significant thing. So it looks like I did the LDD trick where I'm doing looking at everything in user bin. I could look elsewhere, but I'm just looking in user bin and doing an LDD for lib, or what is it? What did I grep for? libmdb. And that comes up for actually quite a few things within the KDE framework. Things that I wouldn't have expected, maybe, like Elisa, E-L-I-S-A, that's the music player that I actually do use pretty much every day, Dolphin, Gwenview, and then some things that I guess I would have expected if I'd thought about it, which I didn't know what MDB was used in, so I didn't expect it to be in really anything, but I didn't not expect it to be anything, I didn't know what to expect, but Baloo, B-A-L-O-O, Baloo, the file indexer uses that, which makes a lot of sense, because, I mean, I think KDE has a little bit of a burden with file indexers. I mean, they've got a little bit of a, you know, people have been maybe burned a little bit by, what was it, Nepomuk, right? I think was the file indexer before. I just always had that off. Baloo I've actually left on, I think, last I looked. Maybe I turned it off, but I mean, Baloo hasn't really sort of negatively impacted like the performance of my desktop, which cannot be said of Nepomuk. Nepomuk, there were times where it was just like, people would just say, well, yeah, just wait for it to index all of your files and then use your computer, which just isn't the modern computer experience, really. So Baloo uses MDB, Gwenview, Elisa, and those are the big ones that kind of leapt out at me. Mutt actually uses it as well, but I would imagine possibly that that's for actual OpenLDAP integration, although maybe not. I was using Mutt at work for a very long time and did have it integrated with LDAP, and I only quit using Mutt because it just became it made less sense to have my email in a separate client at a certain point, and just having it in Evolution, because I use GNOME at work, just kind of made sense because that integrated with the calendaring function and so on. Yeah, Mutt does apparently use it. So it's a featureful database, very fast. That's LMDB. After that, there's Loudmouth, which is a C library for programming in, like, with for whatever, Jabber, the Jabber protocol, working with the Jabber protocol. Jabber protocol is a chat protocol. It was, or I guess the official or generic name or term for it is, what is it, XMMP, I think? Or is it it's got to be XMMP protocol. That's the, no, it is not, XMPP.org. That's the extensible messaging and presence protocol, which are, it's an open technology for instant messaging, for setting whether you're around or whether you're away from keyboard or whether you're busy, chatting in chat rooms with lots of people instead of just one person. It can do voice and video calls and so on. I forget which came first and why the name Jabber is a thing, but as I recall, the XMPP protocol is the underpinning of this messaging protocol, the most famous implementation of that being Jabber. So, and I don't think Jabber is around anymore, is it really? Like, Jabber, that's funny, there's Cisco Jabber. Is that the thing? Like, is that, yeah, I think it must be, maybe not, no, surely not. Cisco couldn't have bought Jabber. Maybe they did, I don't know. Anyway, Jabber used to be like a little open source project where you could chat with friends over what turned out to be the XMPP protocol. Loudmouth is a way, if you were going to write a client, you could use Loudmouth to make that happen. That's really kind of all that needs to be said about this. It's only used in Macabre, M-C-A-B-B-E-R. It is a console client, a chat client that you can run in a terminal to speak over Jabber. I don't remember seeing this in the big long list of applications. So maybe this could, I don't know where this would be. It wasn't in the A set, I guess. Yeah, I'm not sure how Macabre is on my system or where it is in the repository of Slackware installable files, but it is on my system, and it uses, according to LDD, it's the one application in user bin that uses Loudmouth. So that's why Loudmouth is there technically. But you could use that to write your own client as well. Certainly. And I think a lot of these chat protocols that, I mean, XMPP was good enough for Google Chat to use it for a very long time. And then Google, for whatever reason, it would only be speculation to attribute an actual reason. Nobody knows. Somebody knows, but it's not public knowledge. Google decided to not use XMPP anymore. And now their chat client is very much a, I guess, a walled garden, colloquially speaking. It is something that you can't interact with through open technology. I think you can still tap into it, but you need like a Google API key so that you can authenticate through, you know, programmatically and so on. So it is a lot less, well, certainly less interesting to an open source enthusiast, and it's a real pity. But I think when that happens, if nothing else, it demonstrates how robust an open source technology can be. It is a thing that people have relied upon. Like major, you know, Google Talk is apparently what it was called. Even if that was something happening in 2009, when there were maybe, I don't know, you know, a couple million fewer Google users or something, it was still a lot of people. So that's kind of interesting. And I think a lot of these open technologies are important for chat. Well, for the reason that we've not learned today. I mean, think of how many chat clients you have to negotiate with in your daily life. I mean, maybe you don't have that many, but I mean, I'm just a normal guy, and I've got like, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 chat clients installed on my system right now, or, you know, consciously installed. I mean, I also have Macabre, but I didn't realize that was installed. But I mean, you know, like I've got 4 chat clients that I use. And you could say, well, you can use friends or something like that, like one of those aggregators. And yes, I could do that, and that's fine. And that's perfectly, like, that's a great service. But did I say 4 or did I say 5? Because I just remembered I have Matrix as well. So that's something like 5 or 6 chat clients intentionally installed that I use for some reason to communicate with people, whether I want to or not. I mean, like in terms of, you know, maybe something's for work, maybe something else is for this project, this open source project that happens to use this client, and therefore I can only interface with it if I download that client. You know, the coupling, I guess, of the chat protocol with the application that you use to chat, it's a horrible idea. That's a terrible, terrible idea. And I cannot believe that that's where we are now. Like, cause I feel like we've already done this. Like, there was ICQ and AOL and others. You probably have a couple that you can remember. You know, there were these chat, Yahoo chat. I mean, there were these chat platforms back in the early 2000s, late 90s, whatever, probably early 2000s. And definitely early 2000s. Anyway, there were all these chat platforms and people, you know, like would never know how to find each other because everybody's on a different sort of network, as it were. And then we kind of, things got, I feel like things kind of got a little bit normalized, especially with Google Talk using XMPP, because then you could use your whatever chat client you wanted and interface with that person over their Google Talk account or whatever. And other things like Jabber, because that's XMPP. And I think there were connections actually reverse engineered ICQ and AOL as well. I'm thinking of Copete around, I don't know, 2010 or so, 2012 maybe. So you had that flexibility. And now I just feel like we've regressed so much. And once again, it's like if someone happens to open their project server chat account on Discord, then guess what? You're gonna go download Discord. If they opened it on the Google chat, then guess what? You're gonna have to use a Google account to get into that thing and talk to them. And a lot of these are just bound to clients. Like, you just don't really have a choice. And I know that it's probably happening as I speak. Reverse engineering all the protocols and interfacing with things through mirroring chat bots and things like that. All of that's like possible, but it's just, I don't know, it feels like a real step backwards and it just annoys me. An open protocol just makes more sense. It really does. Loudmouth. You can program your own Jabber client with Loudmouth. Let's talk about LZ4. That is the fast and lossless compression algorithm. LZ4, lossless compression, providing compression speed of lots and lots of megabits per very few units of time. And, you know, we've all heard it before. It's compression. It's a library that helps you create compressed files. As I've said before, this is the kind of thing where, as a programmer, the process of creating like a file object on a file system is a lot different than doing it from a terminal. I think for the intermediate Linux user getting into programming, that can be a very, very puzzling thing to get used to. And then it doesn't help that a lot of the introductory languages, I say a lot, I mean Python, sort of goes to some, it does a lot to help you get around that concept by specifically through the shell module. So really, if you're coding, if you're writing a program and you want to create a compressed file object on a file system, then you ought to have a library that does that and writes the bits out in a specific order onto a certain position on the hard drive, and that's how it's done. But for a terminal user, you know, you just do like touch file.txt and then tar cvf create verbose file.tar file.txt that gets tarred up, and then you do a, you know, whatever, gzip on file.tar, whatever. You do that practically in one command. But that's the process, right? You're typing in commands. A library, you don't do that. You invoke methods and functions and things like that to have the computer do that process for you. And in Python, of course, they have the shell module where you import just the shell, and then you write your shell command out as basically entries in a list that Python then executes in sequence. And I think it gets confusing because to a lot of intermediate computer users, it's like you have to, it's a very literal translation of that process. Like, oh, this is how I did it over here in the terminal. Therefore, this is exactly how I'm going to try to emulate it in my code. And it's sometimes difficult to realize, no, you don't have to do it that way in your code. Like, the process can be different, but you have to learn that, or rather you have to unlearn what you knew in a terminal to get it into the correct syntax, or the correct way of thinking about it in code. We see this a lot with, for instance, Ansible, where everyone using Ansible for the very first time, your immediate thoughts are, well, how do I emulate, I don't know, this DNF command with Ansible? Well, you don't. What you do is you check to make sure, or you check whether an application is installed, and then you use some Ansible module to answer that, to solve that requirement if it is not there. But you don't, you know, it's a different process. You're looking at the end result rather than initiating anything at all. And with code, that's kind of the same problem. It's not the exact same problem, but it's similar, because you know how to do it from, you know, point A to point B to point C. But in code, you don't have to do the A and the B. Really, all you need to do is, like, have the library generate C or whatever. So that's LZ4. There's also LZO, the compression library, portable lossless data compression library written in ANSI C. It's pretty fast compression and very fast decompression. I like that. Pretty fast. That's a refreshing change. So that's LZ4 and LZO. And that's the L section. That's it. That's all the L's of the L. Of the L software series, that is all the L's. And I think that sounds like a good place to, or a convenient place to stop. So I think I'll declare the episode over. I mean, we could get into the M section, but it just feels kind of neat and tidy to have done all of the L's, or to gotten through all of the L's. So let's start with the M's in the next episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.